Welcome to Goals Question Time, where I interview leading executives driving innovation, venturing, and strategic change.
So, hi, I'm Andrew Gall. I lead AIM-FR. I've been working in this sort of space for about 20 years now in supporting corporates with their venturing and startup. I came across Edward probably about 5 or 6 years ago, wasn't it, Edward? I think I was following you with your when you launched your book, China Disruptors. So it's really good to have you here today.
Thank you, Andrew. It's my pleasure.
So myself and Edward, what we're going to do is give some introductions and over. So I said, I've got a short presentation to give some context. And then the main meat of today's session is Edward, who is going to be giving some perspectives on China's disruptors, which was the name of one of his books. But I've been following Edward for many years on LinkedIn and his publications through his consulting business and being on the TV and in the press and that within China. We have a YouTube channel, which has previous ones available. And then we've got some workshops around strategic innovation and venturing for organizations that are corporate venturing. And we have a detailed venture capital case study and a video case study we're doing with Unilever. The other interesting topic that AIM-FR is running at the moment is around quantum computing and commercialization in that space. So feel free to get in touch if that's of interest. And another based on video interviews with a venture fund and a startup. So do look those up on Eventbrite. So the meat of today's discussion is really around China disruptors. Now, I've been traveling back and forth to China for about 17 years, been working with corporates and their innovation and venturing probably for about 12 years. And these are just a few images that I put in my book in the section around global innovation superpowers. In that chapter, I probably did about one sentence about Silicon Valley, about a paragraph about Israel, and the rest of the chapters about China. And Edward, I'd be really great to get your perspectives, because I think, you know, I read your book before I published my book, and some of the things that you said resonated with me, and I've got that perspective as well on how China is changing. So I caricatured this back nearly 10 years ago now in what I termed the Great Wall of China, that the China markets have been really quite difficult for Western companies to get into with the language, the culture, but also the internet wall, which has allowed the development of some of these China disruptors. What I termed the New Silk Road, which is different to the sort of maybe what it currently means with the One Belt, One Road sort of policy. But what I meant by this was China's manufacturing has developed from cheap mass produced products like toys to now leading electronic goods. And as some of you on this session, like sort of Angelica and Thomas knows of the likes of NIO, the electric car business coming out of China. So now very high quality, very high sophisticated sort of devices. So China being a manufacturing base for building these technologies. And as we've seen then, the rise of things like the rise of China in its manufacturing and value add that it's gained in that over the years. Then the other perspective I've got is what I term Enter the Dragon, where these China corporates, and with government support and the strategy that comes from developing their capabilities, and we're going to touch on today the 14th five-year plan, is now building the capabilities in China to be leaders in telecoms, high-speed trains, solar panels, and lots of new sort of technologies and new business models and that as well. So that's a bit of a perspective from me, which I've outlined, in my latest book, Purpose to Performance. So those are available on the Eventbrite sort of site. So, Edward, China Disruptors for me was a really interesting book, really well put together, but now a few years out of date, and things have been moving quite fast. But maybe you could kick off by giving us some context to the China disruptors and how maybe it's changed over the last number of years, please.
Yeah, right. Yeah, thank you, Andrew. I'm very pleased to be here this morning, your time, evening, my time. And, you know, in fact, when I published China Disruptors back in 2015, in a way, that was already late by my own point of view. You know, I have had the fortune of having worked in China, as you know, since the early 90s. And, you know, I was representing the Boston Consulting Group at that time. And, you know, that was very early days, as we remember. That was the sort of the beginning of China's opening up for foreign investment in a significant manner. And we were quite lucky because, you know, we went into China sort of ahead of all the other international consulting firms. And yet, just because, you know, when Deng Xiaoping made the visit to Shenzhen in 1992 to remind people in Beijing to continue to open up and reform, that actually also opened up a floodgate for multinational companies to come to China. And we were there to receive the demand from a lot of multinationals. And so we're quite lucky. I was personally very lucky. But along the way, I was also able to get in touch with many Chinese companies who at that time were quite rudimentary, very primitive. Many of them didn't really understand what modern corporate management was all about. But I say one thing that already was very striking about these Chinese companies during the early and the mid 90s was that all of them have demonstrated or shown incredible curiosity about what's going on outside of China, about the Western companies. All of them are very interested in how the best in class multinational companies run the business. And they had the impression that someone like the Boston Consulting Group, being a stalwart US headquartered management consulting firm, would have all the knowledge and all the treasure about how multinational run the business. And so they came to us, and I was, you know, being the managing partner for China, for BCG. So naturally I was on the receiving side. And as an ethnic Chinese, I was able to communicate directly with, you know, with these Chinese entrepreneurial companies in the local language. And so that gave me a very unique perspective about what's going on in China, perhaps soon earlier than almost everyone else. And at a vantage point that perhaps no one else was able to have, certainly at that time. And perhaps over the next couple of decades, as I continue to work in China, because having that direct interactions with the Chinese entrepreneurs and the Chinese ecosystem, really, including both, of course, the privately owned companies, but also the state-owned companies, and also government officials, and people who are associated with the government, like industry associations of various industries and so on. I think it gave me a very direct a way of understanding what's going on in China, certainly from the standpoint of innovations and entrepreneurship, but also giving me the opportunity to triangulate different sources of information. And that really helped me to form a certain set of opinions and perspectives about what's going on in China and how that's evolving. I say that I've sensed the buds or the seeds of China's innovation as early as the early 90s and the mid 90s among these very nascent Chinese entrepreneurs. And by the way, China or the PRC didn't really have any entrepreneurship for the first 30 years of its existence. It only came about, as you know, at the end of the Cultural Revolution, at the end of the 70s, when Deng Xiaoping sort of took on power, and Deng Xiaoping was willing to experiment sort of a new ways or new ways of developing China. And he actually didn't have a blueprint, as you know. He was trying to do experiments. He was trying to cross the river by filling those stones. And one of the things that he did was to allow entrepreneurship to, in a way, to return to China, because before the PRC was formed, entrepreneurship was pretty vibrant in China for many, many years, for many millennia. But that was a big deal for China. And it took China really several decades to get to where China is today. But I say once Deng Xiaoping allowed entrepreneurship to return to China, the Chinese people really took that as an opportunity. And so we already saw the first generation of the return of the Chinese entrepreneurs in the 80s. And then, as I mentioned, in the 90s. And of course, you know, to 2000s, and then this decade, this past decade and until now. I say that growth has been exponential. If you look at this from a cross-section of, you know, time, but also involve different generations. I say China's entrepreneurship have gone through at least 4 to 5 different generations by now. So the 80s, the early 90s, the mid to late 90s, the 2000s, the early 2010s, and all the way now. It's gone through different generations. And so when my book came out in 2015, I was actually trying to chronicle up to that point about what's been happening in China from the standpoint of entrepreneurship, disruptions, and innovations. But the thoughts about writing the book actually started about a decade or so ago, so around 2005. And in fact, I began to collect information along the way as part of my consulting work. And a lot of the information I collected had been available for quite a number, several years before I started writing the book and before the book came out. So that's why I said by the time the book came out, quite a bit of information already from my own standpoint, at least, is a bit sort of dated somewhat. But of course, you know, I think for the rest of the world, and certainly also for a lot of people in China, or people like places like Hong Kong, which is physically close to China, but mentally far away from China, at least at that time, that book was a big hit, because people didn't quite recognize that, in fact, entrepreneurship and innovation and disruptions were really taking place in China. Because as you know, for many people, the impression about China up to that point, or even now somewhat, but much less now, but I say, you know, a decade or so ago, or even, you know, half of a decade ago, people's impression about China was that China was the copycat nation. People, you know, the Chinese just copy, and the Chinese have no considerations for intellectual property rights, and the Chinese are bad, right? I mean, that's the notion. And still there's quite a bit of this notion now, as you know, in the international politics, certainly. But I think for businesses, people who know what's going on in China, who have direct interaction with the Chinese business people, in particular the privately owned entrepreneurs, people begin now recognizing that actually a sea change has been going on. And that sea change is going from a copycat nation to perhaps one of the world's most innovative, if not the most innovative nations, from the standpoint of business model innovations. And so, yeah, a lot of things has happened since I returned to China, but also since the publishing of that book. And as I think you asked me last time when we talked, when would I come out with a new book? I'm planning a new book around this general topic, but I haven't come about to sort of really starting writing it. But it's a very quickly fast evolving topic, but it's also very prevalent to a lot of people around the world, not only people in China, but also people who are doing business in China, and the impact or the effect of China for the rest of the world. So very prevalent topic. So I'm very interested in the topic myself, because you know, this is what I do as part of my, as really my core business. So, so that's the situation.
I very much agree with you that the perception in the West has changed. And I can see your point that from 2005 to 2015, you're living this sort of stuff and you sort of see it. But I've experienced something similar, you know, when I've taken people there. I had the pleasure of hosting Jack Ma in Henley in England in 2004. I thought, well, this is really interesting, this Alibaba stuff. And then was following that through the decade, as you sort of said. But, you know, back in 2015, when you had the book out, you know, I was still there, you know, and traveling to China and starting to see things like the QR codes and the payments and the changing online services and that there. And the perception from the West is still, as you sort of said, yes, they did a bit of copying. They did catching up. But then the Americans came to England during the English Industrial Revolution and copied our spinning jennies and copied our railroad. So, hey, that's what the world is about. And that's what the sort of change is. So just building on your China Disruptor book, you know, you talked about in Alibaba, of course, and Hire and the BAT, the Baidu Alibaba sort of Tencent. Where are we now? You know, so we're 5-6 years on from you publishing that book. Who are the disruptors now, and what's the technology and the business models that you're seeing is really sort of disrupting and changing now? What's your view of that?
Yeah, as you said correctly, I profiled quite a number of companies in my previous book, and of course these companies are by now well known both domestically within China, but also globally or internationally, right, outside of China. And, you know, in the internet space, it was BAT, or Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent, and Xiaomi. I actually intentionally profile Xiaomi quite a bit. In fact, the subtitle of my book was Alibaba, Xiaomi, and Tencent. A lot of people actually didn't know Xiaomi at that time. A lot of people have heard about Ali and Tencent, but Xiaomi was quite unknown. But I knew Xiaomi was not going to be a minor company. It's going to be significant. So I put them in, and sure enough, in the last 5-6 years, it also has grown quite significantly. And recently, as many of you know, they've decided to go into electrical vehicles as well, right? Like so many other people. And then in the non-internet space, you know, the stalwarts like I profiled stalwarts like Hire, Lenovo, and of course Huawei. In particular Huawei, actually quite a bit. And of course, everybody knows the story about Huawei by now, thanks to Donald Trump, right? And the what I said in my book was that what I saw in China at that time was that entrepreneurship or disruptors are happening in a very China-specific manner. Number one is that the entrepreneurs are becoming quite young, actually, are becoming younger, certainly, younger than the entrepreneurs in the first generation, the second generation, as I mentioned, since Deng Xiaoping came back to power. Secondly is that the entrepreneurs in China typically much more geographically dispersed compared to, let's say, to America. America has a lot of entrepreneurs too, but they tend to be quite concentrated geographically on the West Coast, somewhat in the East Coast. But in the Midwest, it wasn't a whole lot or any, right? Whereas in China, you know, we see them in Beijing, in Shanghai, in Hangzhou, in, of course, Shenzhen, big time, but also in the smaller cities, you know, cities along the coast, like in Fujian and also in central China, in Wuhan, Changsha, and those kind of places. So it's much more diverse. And also the other dimension that I saw is that China has a very strong representation of female entrepreneurs, much more so than any other place in the world, including America. And I saw that because I actually interacted with many of them. And I say I have incredible respect for the female entrepreneurs who, you know, really, they were having more or less the same footing of opportunities in China as compared to the male counterparts. And they work hard, they're very smart, and many of them are able to make it. And so I think the nature of the Chinese entrepreneurship have actually given rise to a certain unique aspect about it. And along the way, in the last 5 years or so, 5 to 6 years, we've seen an emergence of equally capable companies who are like the second generation or the next wave after the companies I mentioned in my book. Let's take the internet as an example, right? So at that time, when I wrote the book, Alibaba was by far the dominant ones in e-commerce in China. And today you have JD.com, you have Pinduoduo, and VIP Club, and those kind of companies. And of course, you also have companies who are now very strong in social commerce, which I, as you know, I recently written an article, and social commerce becoming a very fast growing aspect or part of the e-commerce. Yeah, and companies like ByteDance with the TikTok or Douyin part of ByteDance is growing very fast, both within China but also outside of China, as you know. Companies like Bilibili, companies like Kuaishou. These are really fast growing and very successful social commerce platforms. And many of people outside of China haven't really heard about, for example, companies like Kuaishou and Bilibili, but they're very popular, very strong in China.
Yeah, I'd like to delve into that a bit more because, as you said, we know of Alibaba and that now. And, when I met Jack and followed Alibaba from the early 2000s after SARS, China has gone through this dot-com and delivery sort of type e-com, which in the West almost we're only now doing because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And then, China's moved ahead with the social media. So, an entrepreneur that I've been supporting, Rebecca Mortar at Lone Design Club, is in the sustainable fashion sort of type space. And we launched Lone Design Club in Shanghai in October 2019. And, trying to get them to see, the QR codes, the live streaming, that interaction. What are you seeing in that space now that is going to hit us in 5 years' time or sort of something like that? Because I think the amount of time it's taking for Western companies to catch up with China, what sort of things are you seeing now that's happening that those companies you're mentioning?
Oh, incredible. I mean, that's social commerce is really a new way for companies to connect themselves with their target customers or target consumers, right? And previously, the way to do it was only one way, right? You do it through your advertisement, like a newspaper, a magazine, or TV, and so on. And it's a one-way sort of communications. Social media, social commerce actually create, a closed loop, a bilateral way of communication. And also not only with a specific individual like Andrew, you, but it literally with a community who are like you, who share similar interests about certain things. Like, okay, I like outdoor, so there's an outdoor community. Oh, I like cosmetics, there's a cosmetic, baby food, so on. And social commerce is a way to, connect the companies with the target consumers through digital means, and also through the use of, prevalent personalities like the so-called KOLs, right? The key opinion leaders who are usually, well-known, have influence, and really can create a stickiness and resonance with the target customer. So that is what's really going on big time in China. Yeah. And over time, one would expect that to continue to evolve to become much more sophisticated.
Yeah, and I think one of the really interesting points you made there, I'd like to re-emphasize it, is this direct relationship. And if people sort of see the live streaming that happens in China when a key opinion leader might have 100 phones in front of them, that's because they're connecting on different groups direct to their customers, and they're not going like through a Facebook platform or a, right. or you know, an Instagram platform.
That's right.
And I think that's really interesting that the business model in the West of the Googles and the Facebooks all being about advertising, that's being disrupted in China because they're going around them. That's really important to emphasize, isn't it?
I think the real important note to understand is that it's a paradigm shift in the way to connect to the consumers or the customers, to the people. And before it was, I would say, the way that the Facebooks and the Googles of the world, is more digital economy, right? It's a digital economy. Increasingly, these companies, the social commerce companies, are deploying algorithms to really, to create more sophisticated affiliation with the target consumers. So it's no longer just a one-way digital sort of connections, but it's actually a closed-loop, manipulative, algorithm-based relationship. And so you don't need to find them. They can find you, right? And they actually could know you more than you know yourself. That's the scary part of it. But from the business standpoint, it's very interesting. And I say today the Chinese are doing a lot of experiments on how to do that better. You know, someone like a ByteDance or TikTok, let's take an example. I mean, if you think about this, it's pretty simple and naive, right? A video platform showing some, young people dancing, singing, doing some funny things. It sounds simple. Right, anyone can do that in theory, but TikTok was able to emerge from a big crowd and to become the leading platform, and it's become very sticky. It is because behind it, there's a set of very sophisticated algorithms which keep on actually being refined and being fine-tuned almost every day by a large group of algorithm sort of engineers or data scientists. So that's the part that's really driving a lot of what's going on behind these kind of business models.
So a topic I'd like to raise before we come to questions and that from the group, and I see people.
But let me finish answering your initial question, if you don't mind. Just one more comment.
Sure, go ahead.
Because you asked me about which other disruptors, because I know that some of your audience is in the mobility, automotive industry, and so on. I also want to make a mention that, among all the other sectors, one of the most fast-changing and most disruptive sectors is the automotive and mobility sector. And, we have seen, of course, Tesla coming to China and setting up a wholly owned operations and doing quite well, actually. But at the same time, we also see the emergence of the Chinese disruptors as well. And the companies like NIO that some of you have worked for before, and certainly, but not only NIO, right? I think there's a whole bunch of other sort of what we call new force disruptors, the new force, the new auto force in China. So someone like XPeng, someone like Li Auto, another company called WM Motors is not listed yet, but should be on the way at some point in time. But they also are seeing, incumbent OEMs who are trying to transform themselves from a traditional sort of automaker into auto mobility player, which is resting on the notion of all the vehicles is going to be intelligent, connected, and of course increasingly driven by new energy sources. And over time become autonomous. And so that change is incredible. And a lot of companies are evolving, but a lot of them actually are disruptors, the Chinese disruptors who came from nowhere, some of them like the NIOs of the world, but also a lot of the internet players or non-internet players are jumping into the game as well. Xiaomi, as I mentioned, as announced, is going to do go into the NGV space. You know, even Evergrande, who is also a real estate developer, also has set up their own NGV subsidiaries and so on. So it's becoming very hotly competed space as well, but very exciting because with the competition and collaborations along the way, we would expect much more innovation that will be coming in the automobility space in due course.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point you raised there. And the outline that I put in my book, as you know, I sent to you, there's what I term the innovative new value chain.
Yeah.
How these different technologies are going to connect together, because the electric vehicle is a very different platform to the internal combustion one.
Yeah.
The energy infrastructure and clean energy you need is very different.
Yeah.
The autonomous models that then come about when you've got autonomous vehicles, that's a very different value chain. And which country and which companies are going to have the capabilities in those different sort of chains and that. I'm conscious of time, and
okay.
One question I'd like to get your perspective on. The 14th five-year plan, you know, people need to understand and read that. You know, I ran an event with at GE in Paris with a bunch of different corporates about 4 or 5 years ago, and I printed out some key sections from the 13th plan and gave it to these executives that were running hundreds of millions of pounds and dollar funds, and they were like, oh, like they hadn't read it, hadn't understood it, hadn't sort of saw the strategic energy behind it. What should we look out for now in the 14th five-year plan that is going to be impacting businesses and you know, China and the rest of the world? What's your view on those key things that we need to look out for?
Right. As you know, Andrew, the role of these five-year plans is critical in China's governance model. And over the years, you know, different five-year plans have driven the growth and development of China in certain the direction. I say, you know, if you look at the last, you know, 3-4 decades, the performance of China has been pretty well. To a large extent, it's due to the effectiveness of these different five-year plans. And the 14th five-year plan came out, and I say there are two major themes to that that's worth foreign investor to take a look at. One is the emphasis on the so-called double circulation of economic policy. Double circulation meaning, you know, there's an internal circulation of supply and demand within China, but also there's going to be an external circulation, which is China's, you know, trade with the rest of the world. And two things is going to happen at the same time. Of course, in the last 30 years, with the, you know, with that phase of the globalization, China rely a lot on the international trade with the rest of the world, in particular with the Western countries. But you know, China is now foreseeing that in addition to that international trading relationship, China will also will build up the internal supply and demand circle, mainly because of the rise of the Chinese middle class, that the Chinese middle class have now become have reached a certain critical mass. Some people say, you know, it's already in the range of 300 to 400 million people already in the so-called middle class in China, and that number is going to continue to grow. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is innovation in the five 14th five-year plan. The innovation also includes two aspects. One aspect is institutional innovation. In other words, within the institutions in the Chinese system, in particular in the government, but also how the government relates to the society. The Chinese government is committed to create more innovation or more changes or transformation within their own internal institutions in order to push along the growth agenda and also the social responsibility agenda much more proactively. The other aspect of innovation is where a lot of foreign investors should be very interested in, is how technology will continue to play a major role in helping to drive China's innovation agenda. That is instigated by two things. One is how, as we've been talking about, how successful already, you know, for the last decade or more, on how these business model innovation is driven primarily by the entrepreneurs, have already demonstrated So the central government have registered that and they continue to support that. The other is about real technology innovation. This has been instigated by how the previous US administration have started with the sanctions on some of the core technologies like the semiconductor chips to supply to the Chinese manufacturers. And that really have shaken up the Chinese senior leadership that no longer they can really rely on foreign supplies of this kind of core technologies. They need to, or we need to sort of have our own supplies. And so, you know, that has become a major part of the agenda, is to really be increasingly more self-reliant on this kind of core technology like the chip supply. So I think that's also a major theme. The other theme, which is also going to be very prevalent to foreign investors, is a longer term commitment to sustainability, the commitment to become carbon neutral by 2060 was a bold move, as you know. And actually not many people expected that, but President Xi Jinping actually came out and made that pledge. And that's a bold move, but also pretty challenging. And but we know that once the party or the government decided that is the target, they'll go about doing it. But to do that will require a lot of contribution from a lot of different players, including the domestic companies, local governments, but also from a lot of foreign companies who have the capability and technology and are willing to work with the Chinese to try to enhance or to advance its agenda. So I say those are the really most important objectives or targets.
I agree. And you know, for those on this call or ones watching the video, they've got to go and read the plan. They've got to keep up to it. Because as you said, this comes down from the five-year plan down to what happens in the provinces, down to what happens in the cities. I was running a program in Minhang in Shanghai in 2016, and we had the governor came and visited and asked for our advice, you know, asking us for advice. And he said, next year, we're going to build 25 smart robot factories in our little bit of Shanghai. And it was like, wow, you know, this is the scale, the speed, you know, and this is the whole net carbon thing. I think having that plan and then having the entrepreneurs driving behind it, I think is great. So look, those are the questions I want to cover. It's been fantastic oversight. We've got, and Edward, I think there's a demand here for your next English book, which will be, as you said, 5 years out of date for you, but probably 10 years ahead of the time for us. So we really appreciate your time, and thank you very much, my friend.
Thank you, Andrew. Appreciate it.
Please subscribe to future podcasts, and please give us a 5-star rating on your platform. Thank you.